From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, with Robert Mueller's investigation now complete, President Trump goes on the offensive.
We can never, ever let this happen to another president again.
Also today, the impact of Boston's 25 most influential millennial artists of color.
Some of them upend the Boston canon or disrupt it or move it forward in some way. In short, we believe this list is emblematic of a new Boston art scene.
And NFL owners are meeting today as the Patriots face controversy and the retirement of tight end Rob Gronkowski.
Brady with pressure from behind, gets rid of it. Oh! Gronkowski left alone. Breaks off the tackle, and he's in for the touchdown.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. We want to start today with some local voices talking about the results of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into the 2016 election. As we know, that investigation is now over. We don't have the report, but we do know that U.S. Attorney General William Barr's summary, he gave that yesterday to Congress. He said the special counsel did not find the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it attempted to conspire or coordinate with the Russian government to influence the 2016 election. Republicans nationally and locally are celebrating. Here's Massachusetts Republican State Committee member Tom Mountain.
The president was vindicated, and the Democrats are tarnished. The mainstream media is tarnished, and shame on them.
Democrats like Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey say the four-page summary should not be the final chapter of the story.
It took Attorney General Barr less than 2 days to conclude that there was no obstruction. We've got a rush to judgment here by a partisan attorney general on an issue of historic importance.
President Trump spoke to reporters at the White House today and gave his thoughts on the end of the 22-month investigation.
I will tell you, I love this country. I love this country as much as I can love anything, my family, my country, my God. But what they did, it was a false narrative. It was a terrible thing. We can never let this happen to another president again.
Joining me now to talk about all of this is Donald Stern, former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts from 1993 to 2001. Donald, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Chris.
And also with us is former federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks for being here as well.
Good to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this as well. Where do we go from here? Are you satisfied with this investigation? Do you feel the attorney general should make the whole report public? Did Democrats go too far with the Russian narrative? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Judge Gertner, I want to start with you since you've been covering this story from the beginning for us here on Radio Boston and WBUR. What do you get from the four pages from the attorney general? Does it tell us anything we didn't know?
There are a couple of things. First, what Barr said, Mueller said, is that there was no criminal conspiracy. And that's a pretty high, not to use this word, bar, because criminal conspiracy really required an agreement between the Trump campaign and Trump and the Russians to obstruct the election. And he found, which was predictable, that there was no explicit agreement. That's a pretty high bar, and that's as it should be. The obstruction finding was more equivocal. The obstruction finding in the obstruction case, Mueller said that it could go either way, essentially. The evidence didn't exonerate the president. And Barr concluded that if there was no conspiracy to obstruct the election, then if there was no conspiracy with respect to the election, there couldn't be an obstruction of justice charge. And that's wrong. One can obstruct justice whether or not one is in fact guilty of the crime you're obstructing the investigation to prevent. So if Trump were making the decisions with respect to Comey, making whatever other decisions in the case, because he feared that his kids would be implicated, that the campaign might be implicated, even if it didn't turn out to be so, there still could be obstruction of justice. But let me say one other thing about the false narrative comment. If Trump when this first was exposed, had said, man, it's really terrible that there is the Russians hacked the DNC and there was social media interference. Let's look as far as we can. This would have taken a month. It was because he kept on disavowing that which was clear. And people around him kept on lying, that it turned what could have been an easy answer into a complicated one.
Yeah, so we'll start to unpack a lot of that. Donald Cern, former U.S. attorney, I want to bring you in on that obstruction question. From the Barr letter, he says the special counsel states that, quote, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him, end quote. The attorney general went on to say that the evidence was not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense. What do you make of that as a former prosecutor?
Well, it's a little unusual, I guess, to say the least. And we would know more, and hopefully we'll know more, about what Bob Mueller's reasoning was for that when the report becomes public. I think it's important. This is another reason why it's important that as much of the report is public as is possible under any legal standard. You know, there are a couple of, I've been thinking about this, there are a couple of ways to explain Bob Mueller's position on this, where it's kind of, you know, you call it an equivocation. You know, I can't say he's guilty, but I'm not exonerating him. One, which I discount, by the way, is that he couldn't decide, that he was equivocating and he couldn't make up his mind. And anybody who's worked with Bob Mueller, anybody who's observed Bob Mueller, anybody who knows Bob Mueller knows that he is, if anything, thorough, professional, and decisive. So that's just not, in my mind, a possibility. The more likely possibility, and this is really just speculation, but the more likely possibility is he viewed it as a close call, either factually or legally. By factually meaning that there were facts in dispute. It's hard to prove intent. You have to prove it usually circumstantially. Or maybe he was influenced by the fact that the Department of Justice said you cannot indict a sitting president, and that he thought it was more consistent with his very unique role as special counsel in this case, not as a typical federal prosecutor, but as special counsel, to simply lay out the facts and say, here are the facts that dictate or mitigate in favor of guilt or prosecution. Here are those that cut the other way. I would be surprised if he thought, but I don't know this, if he thought that the Attorney General would independently and separate from his report reach a separate conclusion and conclude to the contrary, that there wasn't sufficient evidence to indict anybody for obstruction.
Well, it's an interesting
for obstruction.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You're talking about an attorney general who was already on record before he took this job, had submitted a 19-page memo basically saying he didn't think the president had committed obstruction of justice. And you had Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who wrote the memo justifying Comey's firing. Judge Gertner, I saw you kind of shaking your head in there. What's going through your mind?
Right. Well, I think I disagree slightly with Don. There's a footnote in the Barr letter, and the footnote says we're coming to the conclusion that we are, not because of the principle that you can't indict a sitting president, but because we are concluding that there's not enough evidence to do so. Now, you know,
that was Nancy. That was Barr's conclusion.
That's
we don't
right.
know what Mueller was thinking.
No. That's exactly right. And so I want to understand the difference between what Mueller found and what Barr concluded, because Barr is swooping in here, you know, under a cloud, it seems to me, because of his prior statement about obstruction of justice. The comment that it's not, you know, he's not saying this because you can't indict a sitting president is also a reach. You know, in the sense that he wanted to make sure to everyone that the president was somehow exonerated when Mueller said exactly the opposite. And he does all of that in you know, 48 hours. So I want to separate out what his spin is on the Mueller report. And that's just that whole thing was tremendously troubling.
Do you have an issue with the attorney general making that reaching that conclusion based on comments from the past?
Well, I do. I absolutely do. I mean, he starts off, to be sure, that his comment about this obstruction of justice not being appropriate was as a matter of law, not based on the facts. But still, you know, he went out of his way to audition for this role. And for him to be the final, you know, arbiter of what is obstruction of justice is is very troubling in the light of that. What would have been, what he should have done, in my view, was to say, here's what Mueller says. We will investigate further. Full stop. End of discussion.
And Chris, you alluded to Attorney General Barr's previously disclosed and articulated view, and it's rather extreme, and I think may have informed and probably did inform his decision here, and that is that the president, as the chief law enforcement official of the United States, has the authority to do whatever he wants to and control any criminal investigation in the United States. You know, he can fire Comey, which he had the legal right to do, but even if he did it for a corrupt intent, it doesn't matter because he's the chief law enforcement official, and sort of down the line. And I think that's flawed reasoning, as Judge Gertner points out, the fact that you couldn't prove the underlying crime doesn't mean that somebody can't be convicted for obstructing a lawful investigation looking into that crime.
Or any other.
You or any other.
That's
yeah,
right.
Donald
That's
Stern,
right.
If you could...
It's questionable. I think his reasoning is a suspect. And again, another reason for let it all hang out. Let's see the Mueller report in its entirety.
How difficult is it to prove obstruction of justice? What would that actually take?
Well, yeah, you know, it does depend upon proving a corrupt intent, and it's almost never the fact that you can prove it from the words of the potential defendant. In fact, here we came the closest with President Trump's statement about why he fired Comey, which is because he didn't like the Russia investigation. But it's almost always proved by circumstantial evidence, by what others say, what you said to others, and in some cases what you did. And so it's a hard crime to convict someone of, but believe me, there've been plenty of mafia bosses,
right,
and union leaders and others who, when they say things, even in a very public way, and that's the other fallacy, that just because you're public and open about it, that it can't prove criminal and corrupt intent. And that's wrong. So there are plenty of others who are sitting in federal prison with, I would say, maybe a little bit less evidence than at least based upon what we know of the Mueller's report than is the case here.
Yeah, and there's an interesting question here. And listeners, don't forget, you can weigh in on this as well. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Rudy Giuliani, other members of the president's legal team, have basically said throughout this saga that because these things are happening in the public eye, that you can't possibly bring up obstruction charges. Is there any validity to that? Or does the fact that these things are happening on Twitter and very much in the public sphere, does that matter?
Well, I mean, it is an unusual set of facts. I mean, usually obstruction is quietly done. But a president who basically lives his life on Twitter would obstruct on Twitter. That doesn't seem to me to be peculiar. Just one other point about what Don was saying is Martha Stewart, if you recall, was convicted of obstruction of justice for obstructing an inquiry into insider trading. But she was never charged with insider trading. And yes, it's a difficult crime to prove, which is why there should have been a pause. There should have been, here's what he said about conspiracy, and the other stuff is really complicated. Let's look into it instead of dismissing it in a very peremptory fashion.
All right, one more question for both of you. I'd love to hear your thoughts on some on the left are saying the fact that the special counsel never sat down with the president or even the president's son, Ivanka, Jared Kushner, that really diminishes his findings. Do you agree with that? What do you make of the fact that there was no face-to-face interview?
Well, I think that what happened, which is very troubling, is that I think that Mueller did not want to fight the fight that a subpoena would have engendered. There's no question about that. For the president's lawyers, they also knew that the man doesn't know how to tell the truth. So the notion of putting him in with the special counsel would have opened up doors that they didn't want to open. I don't think that the Don, you would know more about this than I, but it seems to me that the target sometimes provides interesting information and sometimes doesn't. I don't think that that's critical here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Judge Gertner in that. You know, I think Bob Mueller probably made the kind of rough justice calculus, if you will, that, you know, if we push that to the limit, it's going to delay all of this for months, if not longer, and that there's a public interest in wrapping this up, and weighed that against what the likelihood that he would get new and additional information. I think he assumed that you would get a denial from the president. And you know, that really probably didn't add much to what he was already looking at.
To that point, in terms of dragging this out, there was mention in Barr's letter of having to redact information, basically, that could impact other ongoing matters, including those that the special counsel has referred to other offices. Where are we going next with this investigation?
Well, I don't have any doubt that there needs to be a careful review of the report and take out grand jury materials, which are protected. If there are ongoing investigations in New York, maybe Virginia, New York at all levels, and this could impact the publicity with respect to that, or it could impact the fair trial of those individuals. Sure, that could be something. They have to do that very carefully. But I really want to go back to the first point, which is that there was Russian hacking and Russian interfering in the election is clear. That there were members of the Trump campaign that lied about that is also clear. That there were people who didn't disclose their contacts with the Russians is also clear. And therefore, this investigation was legitimate to have begun, no matter where it ended.
Former U.S. Attorney Donald Stern, any final thoughts on where we're headed next?
Well, I mean, let me just make one observation about the redactions. I agree there needs to be two types of redactions, which Attorney General Barr referred to. One is grand jury material, and as Judge Gertner knows, you can typically overcome that with a court order. So that may be solvable, but somebody needs to look at what kind of grand jury information is there. And secondly, there was a reference to, you know, other ongoing investigations, and it's important that those be protected. What he didn't mention or refer to as a possible grounds for redaction, which I was kind of expecting but didn't see, is one possible national security information. I didn't see any reference to that, so presumably that's not an issue here. Nor did I see any reference to the need to protect the confidentiality of third parties not indicted. So he didn't refer to either of those two bases for a redaction. So if it's just simply grand jury and other investigations, I think that's something that is fairly relatively routine and should happen with some dispatch. It's not going to happen overnight, but hopefully it can happen within a week or two.
All right. That's Donald Stern, former U.S. Attorney from Massachusetts from 1993 to 2001. Thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Judge Gertner, I'm going to ask you to stick around for just a minute. I
sure.
want to bring in another voice on this issue, and that is Jennifer Braceras. She's a political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. And don't forget, listeners, we want to hear from you as well on this. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Jennifer, thanks so much for coming by today. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get your initial reaction to this report. What do you make of it?
My initial reaction is it's a complete vindication for the president on the issue of the underlying claim, which is essentially treason and conspiracy to hack the election with Russia. That was the basis for the entire thing, for opening the investigation to begin with. And he's been vindicated on that point. There was no collusion, as he said from the beginning. And I think it's a good day for the president. I think politically, the president should have said that. He should have thanked Don Stern for his work and moved on. Instead, he decided to escalate and up
right.
the ante.
You mean Mueller. He should have thanked Mueller for his
Sorry.
Work.
Yeah. We're just talking to Don Stern. No, right. he should not have thanked Don Stern, although I'm sure he did a very good job, too, when he was U.S. attorney. No, he should have thanked Bob Mueller for his work and moved on. But as the judge said earlier, a lot of the prolonging of this investigation is really the president's own fault for escalating things as he has. And I think the facts speak for themselves. There was no collusion. Our election was hacked by the Russians, but that was done solely by the Kremlin. The Kremlin did not need Donald Trump's help to do that, and the Trump campaign had nothing to do with it. And so he should have accepted victory and moved on. Sometimes he's his own worst enemy.
So some folks on the right are saying this investigation should never have started. Rudy Giuliani was saying that earlier today. What do you make of the investigation as a whole? Do you feel that this was an appropriate line of inquiry?
I think once questions were raised, it was actually in the president's best interest and in the country's best interest to have them investigated and have them settled. And I think that all Americans should be happy to know that there wasn't, in fact, collusion. And all Americans of you know, both political parties should rest easy about that. And so I think there were some specious claims about the president that led to the opening investigation. But once there was a cloud over the legitimacy of his presidency, it served his best interest to have it looked into. Frankly, I think he should have supported that from the beginning. But now that his name has been cleared and the name of those who worked for his campaign have been cleared in this regard, I think that he should accept that and then the country should move forward.
So you keep saying cleared. I do want to point out that what we know, we've seen very little of the report, but we do know that it does say explicitly this does not exonerate the president.
With respect to obstruction. With,
yeah, right. it absolutely exonerates him 100% with respect to collusion. They found no evidence of that.
Right.
And therefore, it does exonerate him.
So I am kind of curious about the legal language here, because that is the headline I've seen in a lot of places. No evidence, no evidence, no evidence. I couldn't find no evidence anywhere in the four-page letter. It does say we didn't find anyone coordinated or conspired, could not establish that anyone did this. Does that legally mean there's no evidence, Judge
Well,
Gertner?
No evidence. What they're meaning is that there's not sufficient evidence of X. And that's not an illegitimate. That's a very important finding. But I want to roll the tape back a little bit. Finding no conspiracy means finding no agreement, usually beforehand, express or tacit agreement with the Russians to hack the election or to do the social media stuff. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it was right to make use, if it were true, of WikiLeaks, of the hacked information that by the time was released, you knew had come from Russian
interference. It's not illegal to share information.
No, but that
issue. It simply is not.
But that's an issue. Well, I'm not so sure about that. But in any event, that's an issue. That is an issue that has to do with fitness for office. That's an issue that has to do with the appropriateness of the behavior of people around him. So one is, what did he make use of information that they knew to have been hacked? Did they? There's actually a concept in the law where you talk about gratuities, where you basically reward someone after the fact. What was the reason for lifting the Russian, or talking about lifting the
sanctions?
And I'm
sure Bob Mueller looked into all those things.
Well, it's hard to know.
Well, yeah, and that actually leads me to my next question.
That's why we want to know.
Yeah, so you've got Democrats calling for release of the full report. As I said, we spoke earlier with Tom Mountain, Massachusetts Republican State Committee member. He says he has no problem with the full report coming out.
We have nothing to hide. The president has nothing to hide. Absolutely nothing. Let the world see it all. Again, leaving out the intelligence report.
President has said, let the people see it. Do you want to see the full report?
Of course. And I actually think we're all in agreement. Everybody wants to see as much of the report as legally possible. What cannot be disclosed by the government is the 6E material, the grand jury material. We all agree that that cannot be released.
Except they can go to court and get an order. In other words, a court can look at the 6E material in camera and then say, yes, it can be released. So there's a process to address
so
that.
In some cases, they may do that if they think there's a particular piece of grand jury information that would benefit the public to know. Maybe they'll decide to go to court and do that, but that's why it's going to take some time. Barr has indicated he plans to release as much as possible. And I think it's interesting. Everybody's just sort of going to their own political corners when there's really not much of a disagreement here. I mean, right. Bernie Sanders screaming at a rally, let's see the report. And Republicans saying, you know, going to their corners and saying this is a complete vindication of the president. We don't need to see anything else. But the reality is, when you really talk to lawyers on both sides of the issue, there's not much disagreement.
No, I think that's right. I think also there's there's like a pecking order here of issues. Crime is at the very top. One can say you didn't do a crime, and that could still mean you did something which would qualify impeachment, bearing in mind, for example, that one of the articles of impeachment for Nixon was just an abuse of power article.
Is a political process.
And then there's a question of fitness. Do we want to know what was done with respect to issues that we care about, even if it's not a crime and even if it's not impeachable? But it is important to know who the man is.
All right.
So I think
I
we agree.
I have to tell you, you wanted to talk sort of about the political ramifications of this. And I think the Democrats really run a risk of overplaying their hand. There have been very few Democrats, elected Democrats, I think none, who have said, we made a mistake. We blew this out of proportion. We trafficked in conspiracy theories, and we were wrong. And I think they really run a risk of overplaying their hand. To his credit, I did hear Jeff Toobin, who's no fan of the president's, on television today, saying, look, I'm not here to be a shill for one side or the other. This is a vindication for the president,
right, but
on
there's
the
a
issue
difference,
of collusion.
But there's a difference between and you agreed to it, that the investigation shouldn't have started, and clearly the investigation should have started, versus what we do now. This particular finding is off the table. I agree.
This particular finding is off the table, and we need to move on feeling secure in the notion that the president of the United States did not commit treason and did not collude with the
Russians. Right. He may have done other stuff.
That's Jennifer Proceres, a political consultant, senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Jennifer, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We want to get one more voice in here for a wider look at all this to give us a little context for the weekend's events. And we're joined now on the line by David Shribman from Pittsburgh. He's the executive editor emeritus of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for The Globe. And he wrote about his reflections from the fallout of the report on Saturday in a piece for The Globe titled "Nixon Clinton Cases Offer Only Limited Guide to National Agony." David, welcome back to Radio Boston. Good to hear from you.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start, obviously, you wrote this on Saturday. Then we get the Attorney General's letter on Sunday. How are you thinking about this report, what we know of it, and kind of the speculations and the conversation we're hearing today?
Well, you know, I'm reminded of what happened in June 1941, when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union, and everybody said all the isms suddenly are wasms. So let's take a look at the isms that suddenly are wasms. All of the Republicans used to think that Bob Mueller was tainted, that he was a closet Democrat, that he was there to prosecute a witch hunt against the president. I was born in Salem. I know a witch hunt when I see one. And all of the Democrats kept saying, Bob Mueller is the portrait of probity, the portrait of comprehensive legal examination, and we're going to go with whatever he has to say. Well, now they've totally switched sides. You don't see that very often. It's quite a remarkable phenomenon, and those of us who are political analysts, we luxuriate in seeing those kind of things.
Yeah, and also I think one thing that's brought folks together is, as we just heard from a couple of voices, everyone wants to see this full report. Is there anything to be gained from going through this detail by detail for the country, do you think?
Well, each side thinks it has a lot to be gained. The Democrats, who dearly wanted Mueller to be able to say that the president was a criminal, are looking for any shards of evidence that he did something wrong and nefarious. And the Republicans, who are looking for any sense of vindication, are going to look for that sense that the president himself has been vindicated. So I think people want to see it, but they also want to see what they want to see in it.
David, one of the things you do so well is to kind of take everything we're going through in the moment and give it some real historical context. Your piece on Saturday, you wrote, "For the third time in four decades, a mature nation with 58 presidential elections under its belt has set in motion a process that will affect and perhaps even cut short Donald J. Trump's presidency. Before that, only Andrew Jackson had faced a crisis over decisions he made while president that resulted in his impeachment in 1868. What's happened in the last four decades? Why has this become such a more common thing here?
Well, first of all, I'm awfully glad I put the word perhaps in there.
Yeah, I know.
Because I don't think the president faces any danger right now of not finishing his office, his term. He'll be there until at least the 20th. Of January 2021.
But what's it say? I mean, this has been an ongoing narrative for 2 years now. What's it say about our present politics?
Well, it says that our politics are fraught, that they are full of resentment, that this is one moment of resentment among many, many. It's, of course, the culmination of the Democrats' dearest hopes and the Republicans' greatest fears, the sum of all their fears. Now we're in a new phase. Candidates are going to have to talk about something else. The public's going to have to talk about something else. And maybe CNN and MSNBC might have to have the final four on instead of the four backers they have on every day.
Right.
One of the lines from your piece that jumped out to me, you wrote, "The wounds of the Nixon and Clinton episodes were deep but ultimately not long-lived. The wounds of the Trump years show no signs of easy healing." Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of where we go from here?
Well, sure. I think you heard in the last couple of minutes that people have retreated to their respective corners, predictable corners, the places they want to be and the place they're most comfortable, where they hear each other talk about either vindication or further prosecution. I think there's no common ground right now. I think the president feels vindicated, but I also agree with Jennifer that he should have praised the depth and probity of the Mueller investigation, said that we're one country, let's move on. Instead, he wants to punish those who've spoken against him. You know, we have the right to say lots of things. Senator Rudman, Warren Rudman of New Hampshire, used to say that we have the, in America, you have the right to say something stupid. You have the right to continue to prosecute a case that probably isn't prosecutable, verbally at least. So I think we're in a situation where the two sides are only solidifying their view. The Democrats desperately want to see that report to find anything they can. The Republicans desperately want to see that report to see if they can find the word vindication or one of its synonyms or one of its homonyms. And so here we are. We're exactly where we were 48 hours ago. The president feels a little better. The Democrats feel a little wounded, but they feel that they might be able to recover. But I think we also ought to take a deep breath and say, maybe these candidates on the trail will talk about issues instead. They can talk about immigration. They can talk about the economy. They can talk about taxes without really saying, let's wait for the Mueller report. We have the Mueller report. Let's move on. I would agree with one other thing. It's not enough to see the summary. You have to see the real thing.
Yeah.
You don't read the summary or the Cliff Notes of Wuthering Heights or of Ivanhoe. You really ought to read the whole book.
All right. Well, that's David Schwimmen, Executive Editor Emeritus of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. His piece in the Boston Globe is called Nixon-Clinton Cases Offer Only Limited Guide to National Agony, and you can find a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. David, thanks so much for the time, as always.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Judge Nancy Gertner, final thought from you. The president today talking about some of the things done in this were treasonous and evil things. What's kind of going through your head now as we look to the next chapter?
Well, again, I think that the investigation was entirely legitimate given the enormity of what the Russians did and given the comments that Trump made and others around him made and the lying about contacts with Russia, the change in the sanctions position, the change in the platform. It was a legitimate investigation. It has concluded that there is no crime, either obstruction or conspiracy. But the American people have to have a larger discussion. Can you imagine, you know, a bumper sticker that says, hey, I'm not a criminal, and therefore vote for me? In other words, there's material in that investigation. There's a material in this discussion about what else we should know, even if it's not the subject of a criminal indictment. What else should we know about what he did, judgment issues, ethical issues, even if it's not impeachment.
Yeah, the line, I am not a crook, has some sort of familiar ring
to it.
Yes,
that's right.
That's Judge Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks as always for the
time. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Boston's 25 millennial artists of color you should be watching. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. A new wave of young artists, curators, and other creative types are transforming the region's art scene, just as public and private institutions are injecting millions into the arts. WBUR's arts team, The Artery, has been following the developments and has picked The Artery 25, 25 millennials of color to watch in the arts. And here to tell us about the artists and how they are reshaping Greater Boston is Maria Garcia, WBUR's Arts and Culture Senior Editor. Maria, welcome.
Hi, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you. So before we get to The Artery 25, tell us, why is this important? Why should people who maybe aren't paying attention to the arts world care?
You know, only because artists produce the physical manifestations of our shared humanity and sort of explain what it means to be human. No big deal. No, but really, artists and creative professionals are change agents. I really think that they provide us with sort of fresh ideas, conceptual frameworks on old quandaries, everything from racial equity to gentrification, gender identity. those ideas produced by artisans sort of shape our culture. Our culture shifts public attitudes, and public attitudes often mold our legislation and our policy.
All right, so let's talk about the Artery 25. You're featuring five of these artists in stories airing all week on WBUR's Morning Edition. Can you give us a bit of an overview who we're talking about?
Yeah, so these are 25 creatives of color who we think you should watch in the next year. They are artists and curators and creative professionals who are shaping the landscape, the cultural landscape in Boston. So we have people like Rasheen Fahandesh, an artist who uses lullabies to help formerly incarcerated fathers connect to their children and their homes. And her artistic practice is shaped by her own experience as a Baha'i woman who had to leave Iran. And somebody else like Sneha Shrestha, who's a muralist who uses Nepali Sanskrit and then uses it with American graffiti, and she's sort of emblematic of somebody who's changing the way Boston, a very sort of tradition-bound city before, who didn't like graffiti up until a few years ago, but who's really sort of shifting the public attitude around graffiti and public art and what public art is, right?
Yeah. So you guys focused on millennials of color. Why did you decide to do that?
So it was an editorial decision. We focused on young people of color because we recognize that diverse creatives have historically been undercredited, underfunded, often unnoticed, and cultural equity, we believe, requires intentionality.
All right. So we said at the top, this comes as institutions are giving millions for art. What changes are you seeing in the region's art scene?
So I really think, arguably, that the city is ripe for an artistic renaissance. There's a renewed sort of financial investment in the arts. It's systemic. We heard from the city last week that awarded the largest ever investment in local arts, $487,000, to more than 200 arts organizations. The Boston and the Bar Foundation's Live Arts Boston grants have infused more than $1.5 million to local artists, 70% of whom are people of color. And that's on top of sort of like long-standing funding mechanisms from the New England Foundation for the Arts and the Mass Cultural Council. So together, they sort of form this very special moment that creates just the right conditions for artists to have the tools they need to take risks, to think big. And that creates a lot of innovation.
Yeah. So money is important, obviously, but it takes more than that to think big, like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. What is it about the artists that you guys have chosen that makes them stand out?
So I really think that they're emblematic of a new generation of creative professionals that's really growing into its power. You know, millennials grew up with a wealth of information. Many of them are digital natives. So they know their respective artistic canons, right? But they're not tethered to them. They're rigorous, but not tradition-bound. Sort of they operate in grassroots, sort of community-oriented scenes, as well as legacy-storied institutions. And they're coming into their own at a time when the arts as a whole, as a sector, is really hungry for diverse voices.
So you've painted a great picture for us, so to speak. can you give us some specific examples of the artists?
So Leila Bermeo, whom we featured this morning on the air, she's a curator at the Museum of Fine Arts. She's Colombian and Mexican-American. And she just had this seminal moment in her career, Chris. She was a lead curator for a big exhibition at the MFA called Frida Kahlo and Arte Popular, which presented Kahlo in this fresh new way that strayed away from sort of these very tired tropes of a tortured artist and instead focused on sort of her cultural lineage between Kahlo and Mexican folk art. And Bermeo, with her curation, really brought out sort of like these overlooked narratives about Kahlo, and it is right now a very popular exhibition at the museum.
So I'm guessing probably diverse artists, curators can really kind of reframe art in a museum in a ways that maybe hasn't been done before.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that museums right now as a whole across the country, they covet exhibitions, right, that are tapped to the zeitgeist, that are tapped to the wider culture. And young, diverse curators and creatives and artists are the key to that. They're sort of tapped to the wider culture in authentic, resonant ways that could attract new audiences. So in this case, for example, with Frida Kahlo and Arte Popular at the MFA, All the signage is in English and Spanish, something Leila Bermeo really advocated for. And it has attracted new audiences. For example, Leila told me about some Spanish-speaking cafeteria and cafe workers at the MFA who've been there for over a decade. And Chris, they had never been to a gallery at the MFA. You know, these are individuals who have worked there for many years, and they had never taken the time to go look at the art. And she told me about that in an interview I had with her. So let's listen.
Some of them have told me that they have worked at the MFA for years and never seen an exhibition. And that, like, hurts me because it shouldn't be that way. But if I can do something to break down those barriers, I would do one every year if it meant that I could make these people feel like that museum is theirs.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can just hear how special it was for her, right? That her exhibition had the tone, the cultural cadence that attracted people who perhaps have before never felt like the museum's galleries were curated for their enjoyment, you know? And it's this ability to recognize unnoticed artists, narratives, stories, and bring them to life that I think creatives of color are really exploring right now.
Yeah, that's incredible. Can you give us another example from the Artery 25?
Yeah, so Tori Bullock, a very fun internet artist whose videos about race and gentrification in Boston reach hundreds of thousands of people. So very sort of like sobering topics, right, about housing and equity. But they're funny and irreverent and a little subversive, but also still sort of really cut to the bone. And so here's an excerpt of a video of him talking about housing changes in Boston.
These apartments are popping up so fast. I'm starting to feel like there's some like meteor coming down from outer space into Earth. And Morgan Freeman is standing here like,
so we've been preparing a network of immense
luxury condominiums.
And the rest of us have to just scavenge and sit here and battle each other Mad Max style on the streets of Boston.
It does feel like the Thunderdome out there sometimes.
Yeah. So, you know, I think he's also really emblematic of this new Boston, these sort of young, diverse artists who are talking about sort of our social quandaries in new, innovative ways. And yeah, he's part of the Artery 25.
Well, that's Maria Garcia, senior editor of The Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team. Maria, thanks so much for joining us. Great to talk with you.
It's been a pleasure, Chris.
Stay with us. Coming up, how are the Patriots faring as Robert Kraft faces charges and the team loses star tight end Rob Gronkowski? I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. And we turn now to some football news. NFL owners are holding their annual meeting in Phoenix, Arizona today. Patriots owner Robert Kraft is in attendance. Over the weekend, he released an apology after being charged with soliciting prostitution at a Florida massage parlor. The meeting also comes after legendary Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski announced that he'd be hanging up his cleats after 9 years with the Patriots. Here to tell us more on both those stories is Boston Globe NFL writer Ben Volen. Ben, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
And I should mention, you join us from Phoenix. So the NFL owners meeting is taking place. As I said, it comes on the heels of Robert Kraft's Saturday statement. He didn't specifically reference the charges, but he did say, quote, "I am truly sorry. I know I have hurt and disappointed my family, my close friends, my coworkers, our fans, and many others who rightfully hold me to a higher standard," end quote. Has the controversy come up at all at the meeting, do you know, and has Kraft had to address it at all?
As far as I know, it has not come up yet. Now, the owners, all morning long, the meeting started today, and they're in these closed-door meetings. I spoke with a few owners yesterday, kind of on background, off the record, and none of them had really expected to talk about it much. They're waiting to see how the legal process unfolds and waiting to see how it resolves before commenting or deciding on how to act with Robert Kraft in regards to any specific punishment. Some of the owners do expect Robert to stand up in front of the room of owners and maybe give something similar to the statement where he's apologizing for bringing a black eye and negative publicity to the NFL and to the Patriots. But I think everyone here is waiting to see how the legal process resolves. I don't know if it's a coincidence that Robert Kraft's court date is on this Thursday, which is the day after the meetings. But Robert has released that statement, and the Patriots have said he's not going to be commenting at all until he gets the whole legal issue solved. So that's kind of what is happening here at the NFL meetings in Phoenix. Everyone is just kind of taking a wait-and-see approach and they want to gather all the facts before they make any judgments on
it's,
Robert Kraft.
It's interesting because the NFL doesn't always wait for the legal process to play out before instituting any discipline in certain cases. Do you have any guess whether or does it feel to you that the NFL is treating Kraft differently than it might a player or an assistant coach or something?
Well, so, a minor quibble there. The NFL, they will suspend players if there aren't charges. Kareem Hunt, a running back for the Cleveland Browns, just got an 8-game suspension, and he was never charged with any sort of crime in the incident in which he got into a fight in a hotel and hit a woman. Ray Rice, the infamous Ray Rice case, he was never charged. So the NFL will punish you if there are no charges, but they do wait for the legal process to play out, and they do wait for the local authorities to finish their investigation before they decide to do any sort of punishment. So I think, again, that's pretty similar to what's going on here. They want to see how this thing resolves. Then once they know the end result, then they can decide whether to punish him. But I do find it interesting that I don't think it's a given that Robert Kraft is suspended. I think he might be able to, the NFL might ask for him to show a lot of contrition and donate a lot of money to various sexual abuse groups and human trafficking groups and trying to make this a big part of his cause now, even more so than he had before. So it's possible that Robert Kraft has to go the contrition route instead of maybe a punishment.
Yeah, we'll see how that unfolds. This meeting's also happening a day after Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski announced his retirement. Kraft has responded, saying in part, "In the 9 years I have known Rob Gronkowski, I have never known him to have a bad day. While Patriots fans are certainly going to miss seeing him play, he will be a Patriot for life." Some folks were surprised by this announcement, others not so much. What about you, Ben?
I was surprised. I thought he was leaning towards coming back just because of how well last season ended for him. He obviously struggled through a lot of injuries. We all saw it. He wasn't quite the same player. But down the stretch in December and January, he was great. He played almost every snap, made some big catches, was great as a blocker as well. So I thought it was trending towards him coming back. But, his body is certainly telling him that it's time. 9 years of getting beat up and a lot of injuries and surgeries have definitely taken their toll on Gronk, and I don't think he was looking forward to putting his body through another grueling offseason of staying in football shape and working out. So it's really unfortunate for the Patriots. The timing could have been better maybe 2 weeks ago before free agency started. Had the Patriots known, they would have gone out and signed another player or two, but it's hard to be too mad at Gronk. He's been an unbelievable player for them, and as you sighed before, a lot of people are going to miss Rob Gronkowski.
Yeah, you mentioned how last season ended. I have to take any excuse I can to relive the glory days. We've got a little tape here of Gronkowski's Super Bowl catch. Fourth quarter against the Rams. Score is 3-3. He's facing Corey Littleton, Rams inside linebacker, and just makes an absolutely brilliant diving 29-yard catch. Let's take a little listen.
Same exact play again. Edelman over the middle.
Second and three. Down the field they go.
The same play three times in a row. Edelman over the middle, Gronk on a seam, and the ball is perfectly thrown, and Littleton can't get there. Gronk lays out and catches it.
So I know you said, Ben, that you were surprised because things have been going so well, but that is a heck of a way to make an exit. You make the key catch of the game, leads to the game's only touchdown. You win a title for your team. I mean, that's pretty much riding off into the sunset, right?
It's a fairy tale ending, and I think most importantly for Gronk, his body is still intact. You know, he's still in one piece, and this is a guy who broke his forearm and had to have I think, four separate surgeries because the plate that they put in his forearm kept getting infected, and they had to keep cleaning it out. He had a devastating knee injury that people weren't sure he was going to come back from in the 2013 season. He's had three separate back surgeries and might be looking at a fourth somewhere down the line. So he's just put his body through so much, and no one has given more to the Patriots. And he's been, for as much of a party boy as Gronk is, he's been a tremendous worker, always does his rehab, always does whatever the team needs of him, has always been ready to go. And when he's healthy, he plays a lot of snaps and a lot of games. So Gronk gave everything for the team for 9 years, and no one can blame him for walking away now while he still rides out into the sunset with the championship and still has his body.
All right, Ben, just about 20 seconds left, but I have to ask you, first ballot Hall of Famer, right?
Sorry, one more time?
First ballot Hall of Famer here for Gronkowski?
I would think so. It takes 5 years to get in, and he was the preeminent tight end of his day, of his entire era. So I would think, yes, first ballot Hall of Fame.
All right, that's what I like to hear. That's Ben Volen, NFL writer for the Boston Globe. Ben, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait. Don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.